Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm Feminist Book Club founder Renee Powers, and it is November 5th, 2020. I'm recording this intro super late. I'm actually recording this on Thursday around 11 a.m. Central Time. I was really hoping we'd have a few more answers by now regarding the presidential election, but we don't. And that is the whole lesson of 2020, isn't it? That we need to sit in this shitty in-between space to wait and see. And I don't know about you, but I am a deeply impatient person, so I fucking hate this part. But I will say this, no matter what, we know a few takeaways. The first, there's a lot of work yet to be done. We've got the popular vote, but that still means millions of people in the United States looked at the last 4 years and said, yep, I want more of that. We have to get back to the drawing board as progressives and figure out how to reach these folks. Figure out how to teach empathy over individualism, people over party. It seems simple to some of us, but it is not. It is a deeply selfish country. It is what this country was built on. The second takeaway is that we did have some big wins in representation, and we should celebrate that. New Mexico elected all women of color to the House of Representatives. Several trans women and non-binary folks were elected to state legislatures. Drugs, weed, I mean, it's a great year for cannabis. The Squad stays intact, and it adds Cori Bush, a Black activist from Missouri, which leads me to the final takeaway, and then we'll be done. The final takeaway is this. We owe an immense amount of gratitude to Black women. Not only did they show up in force for the Biden-Harris ticket, they also worked tirelessly behind the scenes to ensure the democratic process runs smoothly. Huge shout out. I'm a big Stacey Abrams fangirl. So I just want to shout out Stacey Abrams for all the work that she is doing. So to the Black women listening, Stacey Abrams, if you're listening, we are indebted to you. Thank you for working so hard to save our country. We owe you so, so much. Now, election talk over. If you're craving a little bit of comfort, and who isn't right now, grab a cookie, make some hot cocoa. This interview with the inimitable Tana French is just what the doctor ordered. Honestly, this is an absolute joy. I re-listened to the interview this morning right before recording this, and I was like, oh, this is what my soul needed. I'm so glad we saved this episode for this particular week. Our conversation covers a number of topics, including masculinity, westerns, policing, the setting of Ireland, and how Tana French builds settings. And most importantly, Tana is just a brilliant woman, and this conversation is warm and cozy with lots of interesting rabbit holes. Enjoy. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm so excited to be talking to Tana French. Tana is the author of 7 previous books, including The Woods, The Likeness, and The Witch Elm. Her novels have sold over 3 million copies and won numerous awards, including the Edgar Anthony McCavity and Barry Awards, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Best Mystery Thriller, and the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction. She lives in Dublin with her family, and today we are discussing her latest book, The Searcher. Welcome, Tana.
Hi, Renee. Thank you so much for having me.
So we start every interview with the same question, and that is, what does it mean to you to be feminist?
Ah, okay. That is an interesting one. I think it comes down to, for me, the idea of not prioritizing gender over the individual. The idea that someone is not defined first by their gender and then second by who they are as a person. Because just watching daughters and nephews and kids grow up in the world, the problems kick in when people are expected to behave in gender-specific ways, when they're expected to be heard in gender-specific ways, when it's accepted that there is one default point of view, which is a straight white male one, and everything else is a deviation from that. So I think for me, it comes to taking people on their terms as individuals first and accepting that, I mean, gender is a part of that. Gender is obviously a part of what makes us who we are, but it's not in a defined way. It's not in a way that can be universal across everybody. And when there's an attempt to say that gender has to be a certain thing or has to impose certain behaviors, then you're into full-on patriarchy, and I don't like it very much. It's much more about, okay, this is an individual you're dealing with, first and foremost, not a set of genitalia, and I'm going to take this person on individual terms. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the obvious basic that people should have the same identical rights, not only on a legal front, but also in normal everyday conversation and interaction, regardless of gender. It sounds like simple basic stuff, but it's a lot harder to get done than you would think.
That's where that question always ends up, is like, wow, that sounds super simple, but yeah. Why are we in this quagmire of just like suck?
Yeah, why is this not an easy thing that everybody knows?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So how then do you infuse that definition of feminism into your writing overall?
Okay. I think that most good art is inherently feminist. And this is going to sound weird, but I do have a rationale behind it. Okay. The kind of the core purpose of art, as far as I'm concerned, is to give us a glimpse into a viewpoint and an experience of the world that is not our own. Like when you go see a great play or you see a great painting or you read a great book, you're seeing the world from a different perspective. And you're seeing that, whoa, other people experience the world entirely differently from the way I do. And this is valid and this is real, just as real as my experience. And it matters just as much. And the big enemy of feminism and, you know, the big enemy of any equality push is the idea that there is only one right way to experience the world, and that any deviation from that is somehow lesser and less valid and doesn't really count. So when you start getting into art that opens people up to the idea that there are over 7 billion experiences of the world and every single one of them counts, then you're automatically into feminist territory. You're automatically into opening up that door to the idea that the male viewpoint is not the default, that a woman's experience of the world counts every bit as much as a guy's and is every bit as real. And so I guess in my books, it probably comes down to something that simple, where I aim really hard and I work really hard to make sure that the character's experience of the world is made real, and that a reader is drawn into this experience and gets to know the character, male or female, because I've written both genders of narrator. The reader experiences the whole world of the book through that character's history and biases and fears and needs and priorities. And so they're seeing that the world of this book can be experienced in a way that's totally different from the way that anybody else would experience it, and that that's real and that's valid. And again, it seems like a small, simple thing, but we are presented an awful lot of the time with the idea that there's one experience of the world that counts, and all the others are kind of lesser and trivial and can be easily dismissed. So when you fight against that, it is, even obliquely, a feminist move. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I just want to like, I wish I could have one of those rubber stamps that just says cosine. Yes. And what I think is so interesting, shifting gears to talk a little bit about your latest book, The Searcher, is I'm going to ask you to give the elevator pitch. But before that, the way that I see this book, it does, you know, your main character is a man, and it seems like the plot of this book is really this man, Cal, navigating his life around women in difficult situations. And like, what does he do with these difficult situations and what is his place in them? And there's so much about masculinity in this book, which I think is really interesting. And so I want to hear, for our audience who hasn't read it yet, your summary description of the book, and then a little bit about the masculinity at the center of the book as well.
Yeah, it is about Chicago detective who's taken early retirement. His name's Cal, and he's found himself a ramshackle cottage in the west of Ireland, and he's going to fix it up and not do anything complicated and not deal with anything complicated. His marriage has ended in a difficult way. His job has ended in a difficult way, and he just wants some peace and quiet. But a local kid keeps bugging him to find out what happened to his missing 19-year-old brother. And Cal, who had no intention of ever doing anything remotely detective-y again, finds himself dragged into this. And for him, he's always had a pretty simplistic idea of what it means to be a good man, which involves basically treating everyone around you right and getting stuff done. And he would really like that to be that simple. But both in his job and in his divorce, he's been forced to confront the fact that it isn't that simple. I mean, his wife, they spent a long time arguing before they divorced. It's not a big part of the story, but it's definitely thrown in there. They spent a long time arguing about how you deal right with complex situations, whether you offer them what you want to offer or what they require from you, how you respond to someone in your life who has needs from you. Do you offer what you think is best? Do you offer what they need? And Cal is kind of having to come to terms with the idea that being a good man doesn't necessarily mean always fixing everything, which is how he defined it. Being a good man is treating people right and fixing stuff. And he's forced to redefine that over the course of the book.
Yeah, I love Cal. I see so many of the men that I know in Cal.
He's a good guy.
He is, especially, you know, like you said, he has this quote unquote code of what's right and wrong, you know, that to be a good man, you do what is right. And this is what is right. And he has this great kind of monologue that he tells this 13-year-old kid, Trey, about manners versus morals. And I'm curious if you would be willing to kind of share Cal's perspective on this, and how did he come to these definitions of manners, morals, what's right and wrong, and of his code, his personal code of honor?
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with Cal on all of this, because he doesn't feel that words really matter, for example. He feels that only actions matter, whereas, you know, I'm a writer, of course I feel that words matter. But his definition is that manners are, you know, things like calling people what they want to be called, that's a matter of manners, all that stuff. But morals are the stuff that you do no matter what anybody else does. Like if somebody treats you badly, if somebody's an asshole to you, you might tell them to fuck off. You might, you know, you might not treat him in a mannerly way. But if you see him in a burning car, you're still going to open the door and pull him out, because that's a matter of morals. Morals is the stuff that doesn't change no matter what anyone else does. And I think he's come to this. Cal is somebody who didn't have a father around when he was growing up. He had his granddad. He had his mother was in and out because she was, you know, working too hard. So she had to leave him with his granddad. But his father just showed up for a couple of weeks here and there with candy and card tricks. So he's had to make his own definition of what it is to be a man. And he's come up with one that is extremely concrete. For him, it's all about actions, probably because there was so little solidity in his life that he places a very high premium on solidity, on things that you can see, hear, feel. So for him, being a good man and being a man is all about action. Words don't really mean very much to him. And he's come up with that based on what he needs. I think as many of us do. Our own moral codes come out of our own needs, especially people who have had to make them up more or less from scratch without an awful lot of help. And he finds himself, without intending to be, in the role of some kind of father figure to this 13-year-old kid whose dad has run off to London and who is looking for someone to demonstrate how to be an adult, how to grow up. Cal finds himself in the position of somehow being a role model that he didn't want to be, and having to define his moral code and having to make sure that he upgrades it when necessary in order to give this kid what's needed.
One of the things I found super interesting is why Cal took an early retirement and wipe his slate clean and up and move to Ireland. And I think that this speaks to that moral compass too. Can you talk a little bit about the impetus for him to move?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had been, this is going to be a bit of a long rambling answer, but I'll get there in the end. Around the time I was bouncing around ideas for this book, I'd been reading a lot of Westerns. And I've been thinking, okay, these settings have a lot of resonances with the West of Ireland. Like, it's harsh country. It demands both physical and mental toughness from anyone who wants to make a living there. And it's this place that's both geographically and culturally, it's very distant from the centers of power. So people who live there feel like they've got no option but to make up their own rules and enforce them themselves if they want a cohesive society, because the power brokers don't know or care much about their lives. And so I was thinking about moving some of these Western tropes to the west of Ireland, seeing how they transposed. And one of the things about Westerns is they tend to be really deeply involved with the idea of morality, of right and wrong, right? So I've been thinking a lot about morality because I think a lot of us are these days. And there's this urge to make it simple. There's this urge to go, oh man, this person liked a really vile comment on Twitter, so he must be evil, end of story. Or else, this person does awful things to other people on a regular basis, but he says he's religious, so he must be a good person, end of story. And the thing I liked about Westerns is they're really matter of fact about the complexity of morality. There are always people trying to do right in situations where that's not an option. There's the fact that mostly good people sometimes do bad things, vice versa, and people of every kind can find it really hard to cope with this. And Westerns don't try to gloss over that complexity. They don't deny it or explain it. They just lay it out. So I went, okay, if I'm writing a book that's got some tinges of Western in there, it's got to be underpinned by that focus on right and wrong and how complex they are. And that meant that that had to be central to whatever had driven Cal to Ireland, which was the ending of both his marriage and his career. And in his career, it's an incident where his partner almost shoots a black teenager who's running away from them and who he thinks may have been going for a gun in his pocket. It's unclear. And Cal feels that in that incident and in his response to it, he has completely lost touch with his moral code. Not only has he lost touch with his moral code, but he's got a line in there where he goes that one or the other of them, him or the job, can't be trusted. So not only has he lost touch with his moral code, but he's found himself within a system where it may not be possible to have a moral code. And to him, that's a huge shock. It's something that he feels that he can't be part of. And so that's what sends him not only far from being a detective, but halfway across the world, because he's going, once he's thousands of miles away from these complications, when he's not a detective anymore, maybe he's going to be able to get a hold on right and wrong. He's always wanted to be a good man. He's tried to be a good man. But given this incident, he's not sure he can count himself as one. And he's not sure that he can count the process of acting as a policeman as compatible with being a good man anymore. And to him, that's a profound shock, because he went in there partly because it was a steady job, but partly also because it was a way of fixing things, as far as he was concerned. And he likes fixing things. And it's brought home to him that it may not be that. And not only maybe being a policeman isn't fixing things, keeping people safe, but it may not be possible to be what he considers a good man within that framework. Hence a cottage in Ireland.
Which sounds so romantic.
Yeah, at first.
Exactly. I love that you take this perspective, and I'm curious that since you've lived on both sides of the pond, as they say, I was listening. This is going to go down a rabbit hole as well. I was listening to an episode of, I just had the radio on in the car, NPR. I think the program was All Things Considered, and they were interviewing. Just civilians or maybe journalists in Bristol in the UK, and talking about the difference between policing philosophy in the UK and in the US, and the protests that happened after the murder of George Floyd here in Minneapolis that erupted in the UK as well. And some of the people that they interviewed, they brought up this point that I thought it was so interesting, that the police in the US enforce the law by any means necessary. That is their policing philosophy. Whereas in the UK, the police are there really to maintain the peace. And they have a philosophy of policing with consent. I say all that, first off, because I found that fascinating. Second, because you have written your first American character in Cal, you've made him a police officer and you've moved him to Ireland. And he's trying to get away from all of these things because he has a brilliant level of reflection of his career and his moral code, right? So he wants to leave this system where, as you say, his moral code may not be possible. And he finds himself in a different system with different codes. And so,
yeah.
This is a very long question. So I'm wondering, what does Cal do with that, right? What is, does he find that limiting? Does he find that freeing? Does he find that frustrating in different ways? And what do you think that he realizes? And what did you realize as a writer writing him in these two very different environments in relation to policing, especially?
Oh, they are very different environments. Now, I'm in Ireland, not the UK, so it's slightly different again here. But our police are actually called the Garda Síochána, which means guardians of the peace. Like, that's their official title. And even once you get to the practical level, like, our uniformed police, they don't have guns. So nobody is getting shot on the street by a uniformed police officer because they couldn't. You know, it's not a possibility. I think the last time the police killed anybody in Ireland was, I don't have the exact date, but it's about 10 years ago. And it was two white guys in the middle of an armed robbery. And it was a huge thing because this basically never happens. So we've got an entirely different relationship with the police. I'm not saying it's idyllic because obviously the Garda Síochána thing, the guardians of the peace, is a goal and it's an aspiration rather than always a concrete thing. And the ideals are never universal in practice. That's just not how human beings work. But that's the philosophy behind it. So I think Cal is coming into something that's very different for him. But also he's coming into a setting where it's the back of beyond. There's not all that much call for policing. And there's also the fact that the family he's dealing with, this kid and the missing brother, come from a family who are sort of kind of slipped through the cracks. They're poor, they're feckless, they don't get much done. The dad never held down a job, the kids don't go to school. So when the older brother turns up missing, the police don't really care. They just reckon he went off somewhere and it's not really their problem. He's 19, what are they going to do? So he's dragged into being a detective again, partly because of this. But then he discovers that he's being a detective with all the artillery of that position stripped away. On the most concrete level, he doesn't have his gun anymore. And he is having a hard time even getting one because the licensing laws over here are pretty strict. But also, he doesn't have any of his connections. He can't find the missing guy's phone records. He can't get some computer guy to go through the missing guy's phone records or his bank records. And he can't, you know, pull criminal records on any suspects and associates that he might have. He's got nothing except himself. So not only is there a big contrast culturally in what policing is and what it means to the community, but there's a contrast in what being a detective has meant to him back at home and what it means to him now. And he has to fit it in on a kind of illicit level, because he's not supposed to be a detective, with a very small, tight-knit community that has an automatic distrust of any form of authority because they've set up their own society, their own personal policing, their own rules and their own methods of enforcement. So he's in an odd position of having been in a position of authority most of his adult life, now not having any authority or any way to enforce it, and trying to follow this process that has been familiar to him in a context that's utterly different, unfamiliar, and not really on his side. He's juggling a lot of balls there.
I could talk about this philosophy as it relates to your book for the full, you know, 30 or 40 minutes, but I do want to switch gears and talk about a few other things. The setting is so rich and so lush, and you have a knack for really writing. You have so much respect for your readers that you are willing to kind of take them deep into a setting of a book. One of the things that struck me is we begin and we end, this is not a spoiler, do not worry, discussing the rooks in Kel's yard. The, you know, rooks are corvids, like American crows, very smart creatures. Was that just a poetic device to end, to start and end with these rooks, or is there a metaphor there that you'd like to talk about?
The rooks just kind of happened. I mean, the whole setting, I love the west of Ireland, right? It's completely different from where I live. I live on the east coast of Ireland, and they're both beautiful, but it's such different kinds of beauty. The east is, it's much gentler. It's this lush, green, soft hills, very gentle. When it rains, it's gentle. The waves are gentle. Over the west is, it's much harsher. It's wilder. It's got Atlantic waves and Atlantic winds. And, you know, half the trees near the coast will be bent sideways by the wind coming in off the ocean. And I loved writing about that. And one of the things I wanted to capture was this sense of the wildness and of nature being very much present and humans not being exactly in full control. You have to accept, if you live in the West, that you are dealing with forces of nature that are not under our control. It's a reality. You know, there are floods, there are wild winds, there are things like that. And the brooks just kind of happened initially as this image of Cal watching nature at work and going, probably I shouldn't interfere because I'm the new guy on the block. I'm a stranger in town. I probably don't really have a right to do anything but let it play out its own way. And of course, over the course of the book, it doesn't work out like that. He's dragged in and he does end up interfering in this place where he's a stranger in town. And it just felt right to come back to the rooks at the end and to have him where he was at the beginning, only in a very different place mentally.
Almost as though he now fits into this place.
Yeah, he's earned his place here. He's put down his roots. And he's had to make that decision because it wasn't something he really wanted to do. One of the things about a small community is that what you do has more of an impact. Like if you're living in a big city, then as long as you don't play your music too loud or have loud parties, you don't have to have much effect on your neighbors if you don't want to. You can live almost in a vacuum. Whereas if you're down the country, you do have an impact. You do make a difference to how that community plays out. One of the other characters, Lena, kind of points that out to Cal. The fact that the young women go off to the cities to find better jobs means that the young men who are at home looking after the farms have nobody to marry. And then you get all these old bachelors getting old, which changes the tone of the community. So an individual's actions have reverberations throughout the village, throughout the community. And that's one of the things that Cal has to come to terms with, whether he likes it or not. But if you live here, your actions do have repercussions. They have ripples that spread. And by the end, he's come to terms with that and he's willing to be a part of that. So yeah, he's put down those roots.
A lot of your novels, speaking of setting, feature a house as the center, yeah. Right? And I love when settings and locations kind of become their own characters in novels. It's one of the things I love about Friday Night Lights, the TV show, is I feel like Texas is its own character.
Yeah.
So in this book especially, what does Cal's home symbolize? And if anything, and what do you think is so important about having this house at the center of the narrative?
Well, I mean, I like houses. They show up a lot in what I do. I think I blame it on the fact that we traveled around a lot when I was a kid. So we were constantly moving house and we never bought anywhere. It was all rented. So the idea of a house that is your permanent home was kind of a big deal for me as a kid. And that crops up a lot in the books. And for Cal, I mean, this is a guy who's come to feel that he's not at home within himself anymore, that he's been dislocated from his own sense of self and that his own mind is not what he thought it was. He's no longer able to see himself as a good man, which is a good, steady guy, which is what he always wanted to be. And so he's been deracinated and taken out of his sense of feeling at home within his own mind. And for him, I think the house probably has to do with that. It's a way of making, building something, rebuilding something, refurbishing, repairing, fixing, and feeling at home within something again, recapturing that sense of being solidly and comfortably at home that has vanished for him.
Yeah, so well put. again, the setting of this is just so rich. I loved it. For fans of yours, because this is your seventh book, or your eighth book.
Eighth book, yeah.
Yes.
Wow, I'm still kind of startled by that. I'm a few books behind.
Oh, sure, okay.
Just going, man, eight? Really? How did that happen?
So for fans of yours who have read the seven previous books, how is this one different? And why do you think readers should pick this one up as well?
Pick it up because it's got a gorgeous cover. The publisher did an amazing job. Isn't it beautiful? Really, you have to see this cover. It's different. Well, it's different partly because, like, I don't want to fall into the trap of writing the same book over and over. And I think it's an easy trap to fall into, especially if you write genre, even slightly off genre, because the basic arc is so fixed. So, you know, A kills B and C finds out who done it. It's really easy to slide into going, okay, well, I know a way that makes that arc work. I'm just going to keep doing that same method over and over again. And I didn't want to fall into that. I don't want to fall into that trap. So with this, I was trying to do some slightly different stuff. In The Witch Elm and in many of my other books, the focus of the action, the core of the plot arc, is within the narrator's head. That's where the most crucial action happens. So I wanted to write something where it wasn't first person, it wasn't about introspection, it's about the main character's actions. And that's why this one's third person. It's about what he does, much more than about what he thinks and feels, which to Cal would, in fairness, be the crucial point. And it's set in a whole different setting. It's down the West instead of being in Dublin. And the West, like I was saying, has an entirely different beauty to it. It's an amazing part of Ireland. And it's about a whole different kind of community. It's also one of probably the first of my books where I don't go back to this idea about the relationship between past and present, because that's something that fascinates me. And I think that's something that is a pretty crucial part of the Irish psyche, is how do we bring past and present into balance, into harmony, and move forward into the future without either destroying or denying the past? How do we harmonize those two? So I've dealt with that a lot. I've gone back to that a lot. And in this one, I was like, okay, no, this is not going to be a book about the relationship between the past and the present. So it's very much Cal in action in the present. And he is, as far as I'm concerned, he was a nice character to spend time with. Now, I don't know if he is the good man he wanted to be, or the bad guy that he's worried he's become, or what is he? But he was nice to spend time with for 2 years of writing him. So I think if I was telling people a good reason to pick up the book, I think anyway, Cal's pretty good to spend time with.
I would agree with that. Like I said, he reminds me of so many of the American men that I know in my life.
Oh, and
that I know and love. Flaws and all.
Yeah.
So we are winding down, and I am so grateful that you spent this time with us today. And we end with the same couple of questions, and they're easy ones, so don't get nervous. The first question is, do you have a book that you would recommend our readers check out that is not one of your own?
Oh, I have so many. My God, I just want to start listing books.
We can do a few.
Okay, here's one that probably is less well known than, you know, a lot of others that I would recommend, because I could just list books all day long. But The Watchmaker of Filigree Street by Natasha Pulley. I'm not sure as many people would have heard of this one. It's set in Victorian London, and this mysterious gold watch saves Daniel Stapleton from a bomb blast. So he tracks down the guy who made the watch, who is a Japanese immigrant called Kate Amori, who's got a mysterious, complicated past. And meanwhile, there's this woman, Grace Carroll, who she's really intense, she's really studious, and she's trying to escape from marriage, which she's being pressured into, and prove the existence of luminiferous ether. And then their lives intersect and they're transformed. And it's this marvelous combination of like magic realism and thriller and historical fiction and love story and great writing, just wild imagination. And it has a clockwork octopus that does unexpected things.
What?
So you can't go wrong.
Honestly, I just want you saying the phrase luminiferous ether on loop as like my ringtone.
It's one of my favorite phrases of all
they
time.
Say cellar door is the most beautiful phrase in the English language, but I beg to differ now.
Yeah, luminiferous ether has to be right up there.
So that was The Watchmaker of Filigree Street. Would you share the author's name again?
Yes, by Natasha Pulley.
We will leave a link to that in the show notes, as well as to all of your books, especially The Searcher, which is fantastic. Go check it out now. Where can we find you online if we want to see what you're up to?
It's tanafrench.com. And I think Viking is very good at keeping it up to date with all the news. And there's been a bit of switchover at the moment with websites of Viking authors. So I'm not actually sure where the best place is. But tanafrench.com is there and tends to be mostly up to date.
Okay, perfect. We will leave a link to that as well. Is there anything we didn't get to that you would like to share today or what you're working on next?
These have been really interesting questions, and thank you so much. Make me think about the book in whole new ways, and I love that. Working on next, I am not where I should be because the same as everybody else, my brain's fried.
Yes.
Like I think we have just a collective global brain fry going on here where we're all fucked mentally.
Yes.
Like our bandwidth is gone. And I'm realizing how much you need your subconscious to come up with a book and process ideas into something that's actually workable. And we don't have subconsciouses right now. They're completely used up by just dealing on a day-to-day level. Mine's a smoking crater. It smells of burnt toast in there, you know? I'm not getting as much done as I should. So I have an idea for a new book, but I'm still at the sort of bouncing it around and seeing where it takes me stage. Might take a little longer than usual, but it'll get there in the end.
I'm sure it will. And again, like you said, those shoulds, let's not should all over ourselves because there are no shoulds right now in a pandemic. So I hope that you stay safe and healthy and take care of yourself during this, like they say, unprecedented time, but really it is.
Oh God, yes. You too. Stay safe out there.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.